coming today. You may be seated. And we have the Richland Center High School students. Would they stand, please? Thank you for coming, and you may be seated. The students are here today with a national award-winning program called Court with Class that is sponsored by the State Bar and the Supreme Court of Wisconsin. Students from across the state are invited to come. They are given materials about the case that they will hear with us, and sometimes the students have attorneys and others visit with them to talk about the case. It's been a wonderful program. We appreciate having the students here, and the students are also invited to come at noon or after our second case is completed, and you all are invited to come and speak about the procedures of the court with a justice. And today, that justice is Justice Sykes, who is seated on my far left. And let me introduce the rest of the court. Seated next to Justice Sykes is Justice Patrick Crooks. To my immediate left is Justice John Wilcox. I'm Shirley Abrahamson, the Chief Justice. To my right is Justice William Babbage, and to his right, Justice Ann Walsh Bradley, and on the far right, Justice David Prosser. With those introductions made, we will call our first case for today, 01-1256, Jerry T. versus Bad River Band of Lake Superior Tribe of Chippewa Indians. Arguing for Bad River Band of Lake Superior Tribe of Chippewa Indians is attorney John E. Jacobson, and he will be introduced by Wisconsin attorney Henry M. Buffalo. Attorney Buffalo.
Honorable Chief Justice and Honorable Justices of the Court, may it please the Court, I am grateful to be here once more in front of you with respect to this case. I am myself an enrolled member of the Red Cliff Band of Lake Superior Chippewa. One little bit of history for you. At one point, both Red Cliff and Bad River Band were jointly called the LaPointe Band of Chippewa and were located on the Madeline Island. Today, I'd like to introduce to the court my friend and partner, Mr. Jacobson. He is a member in good standing of the Minnesota Bar, and I move his admission for purposes of making the oral argument today.
Thank you, Attorney Buffalo, and your motion will be granted. Mr. Jacobson, you have 25 minutes and then 5 minutes for rebuttal, and Ms. Hannon has 20 minutes and Mr. Erlinson 10. Is that correct? Fine. You may proceed, sir.
Thank you, Chief Justice. May it please the Court, my name is John Jacobson.
Mr. Jacobson, I think you'll have to lower the mic. Right. Fine.
Hope that's better. My name is John Jacobson. I am an attorney practicing with the firm of Jacobson, Buffalo, Schessler, and Magnuson in St. Paul, Minnesota, and we represent the appellant, Bad River Band. As I stand here at the podium today, you perhaps discern that I'm not standing alone. I am accompanied by a number of viruses. And so I was thinking this morning that perhaps I could ask your indulgence, and if I say something in the ensuing minutes that just makes absolutely no sense to you at all, you can assume it's the virus is talking.
Right, because several of us have a similar virus.
My sympathies. The case before you this morning is a case of tremendous importance. The relations between the state of Wisconsin and its institutions and the 11 tribal governments in this state and their institutions have a history, obviously, as long as this state has been a state, and predating that when it was a territory. The relations will continue for as long, I suspect, as there is a republic. The relations have evolved and are evolving today in ways that are tremendously important. In large measure, because for the first time since the founding of the republic, tribes in this state and elsewhere begin to have, and that's begin to have, the resources that governments require to do the jobs of governments, to build the institutions, to build the laws, to build the structures that a government needs to serve the people. Among them, and I needn't tell anyone here this truth, but I will say it, among them most centrally is the institution of courts. This case, now 7 years old or more, involves directly and profoundly the relationship between the state courts of Wisconsin and the courts of the tribes of the state, specifically the tribe of the the court of the Bad River Band of Lake Superior Chippewas.
Counsel, I wanted to give you a few minutes to give us your introductory remarks, but I have a preliminary question the court does. With respect to the protocols that were adopted in December of 2001, obviously there's an interest in all of us seeing that disputes such as this are resolved between courts without rancor and without anybody imposing their wills on each other, at least to the extent that we can avoid it. I note that in December of 2001, protocols were adopted by both the 10th District and the Bad River Tribe to resolving disputes in which there is concurrent jurisdiction. This obviously is a case where there is concurrent jurisdiction. And although this was adopted well after the case arose, what objection, if any, would your client have to this court remanding this case once more, now that we have some teeth, now that we have some protocols, to resolve this case consistent with the protocols?
It is a question that we've pondered. We think the protocols that were adopted are, well, obviously had they been in place when these cases arose, we wouldn't have been here the first time, much less this time. They are a tremendous advance, and I think would be regarded nationally as a model for the way in which these matters should be approached. Should this court choose to remand, obviously the band will participate and will proceed in accordance with what the protocols contemplate. I think there are two difficulties that we have to acknowledge. The first is that the protocols are written in such a fashion that they are designed to intervene before judgment. They are designed to stop what happened here, because as soon as there is an awareness on any party that there are two cases, the protocols intervene, and they intervene forcefully. What would be required should there be a remand would be the creation of something more. We have two judgments. We've gone past the point where there is a need to allocate jurisdiction. Both courts acted and rendered judgment under the law that was extant at that time. We are now 7 years into a process, and the band is of the view that there is, in fact, a statute in place that governs what happens when there are judgments. In the 10th District, and with the four tribal courts that signed the protocols, the four tribes that the territory lies within the 10th Circuit, presumably, as long as the protocols are in place, this situation won't arise again. But I think my answer must be that it has arisen now, that it is, that the protocols themselves don't really deal with the situation where you have a judgment. They seek to avoid this situation.
But as I look at, if I may interrupt for a moment now. As I look at subsection 7 of the protocols, the standards that would be applied, at least I think an argument could be made that these are the standards that we ought to take into account if we decide not to remand, but to decide this case on the merits, the full faith and credit. And if we're going to do that, and maybe you think that's a bad idea, and if you think that's a bad idea, I'd like to know that. But if we're going to do that, maybe we should do it as a matter of first instance with the and essentially put this into the posture as a case of first impression. You know, try to unscramble the eggs, so to speak.
Justice Babbage, it seems to me that doing that would write out of existence 806.245. And I don't mean to ride a hobby horse, but there is a statute, it seems to me, that the legislature passed, which must contemplate a situation where there is a potential conflict between two courts and two proceedings. This court and this state has adopted in the majority rule in the United States, which is that a court with jurisdiction that renders judgment establishes the law of the case, and full faith and credit should be given. If this had arisen not in Van River but in Iowa, we wouldn't be here because the Iowa judgment would be given full faith and credit by the circuit court in Ashland County.
Well, go ahead, sir.
If we say this is a different sort of full faith and credit, it seems to me to ignore the standard that the legislature said full faith and credit the same as is given in other circumstances. We have here a state court judgment rendered with the notion that the tribal court didn't have jurisdiction because of Cyber versus Hahn. This court vacated that judgment because Cyber versus Hahn didn't apply. The first, and effectively, thereby, I think, did away with a first-to-file rule. If this court were to consider this matter and say, well, somehow the protocols have superseded or overlain 806.245.
I'm not sure that that's what I'm asking. To be very candid, I am very reluctant to be put in a position, if I can avoid it, of either telling the Bad River Tribe that you lose. For comedy reasons, for relationships between another sovereign court and this court. It seems to me, does not do any of us much good. On the other hand, I'm very reluctant to do the opposite. The parties here are putting this court in a very difficult position. At least me, I can't speak for the court, but I feel like I'm in a very difficult position.
It is. Yeah, speaking as legal counsel for the band, but also speaking as a person who, when Henry Buffalo last introduced me. Actually, I hope and suspect that the court doesn't recall it, but I was rather embarrassed. It was. He described a person that I don't know, but one thing he did say was accurate, and that is that I have served, and continue to serve as a tribal court judge in Minnesota. I have done so now since 1988. And speaking as a tribal court judge or as a judge, I sincerely appreciate the court's concern, your concern, Justice Pavlich, and your feeling that this is a difficult case. It may be, and I obviously the court is empowered to the case is before you to decide. What I urge the court to do in deciding, in addition to, again, considering the force of positive law that is 806.245 and the history of this, where the circuit court made its reached it, allowed itself to come to judgment on an erroneous notion of its of the fact it believed that the tribal court had no jurisdiction, it believed that it had been foreclosed.
Can I just interrupt, because I think maybe this should be just to enlighten me. Now this case has gone to was submitted to arbitration.
Yes.
And then there was an award. I mean, then there was an award. And then it came back. And then, so we're talking about, you're talking about eviscerating 806.245, which is obviously the full faith and credit. It just, there's an awareness, at least, of how the history of this and how, you know, we have these two competing things, and then there was arbitration, and then you had a circuit judge take a look and basically assess the full faith and credit and say, well, that's certainly it's there and I believe in it, but there are facts in this case which may require comity, or at least would say, well, maybe we will not apply, or does not apply. And my question is, what value do you give to the arbitration that was done?
The sequence is very important, and also the underlying contention that the band has throughout, and that was brought before the tribal court, again with Mr. Teague declining to submit his views to the tribal court, never has. But the band has contended that neither of the documents at issue here, the 93 or 95, are valid documents, are valid contracts. They're void because they were the effect either the other of actions of a government or of a corporation. The requirements underlying the documents never were met. That's been the contention from the beginning. Therefore, the contention has been there are no arbitrable issues. I'm going to just briefly.
Did the arbitrator decide that issue?
Judge Gallagher ordered him not to.
Okay.
Judge Gallagher specifically in his order, I think I have the date here.
Judge Gallagher thought that was for the circuit court? Is that the point?
Yes. November 5th, 1998, Judge Gallagher.
We can check that out.
Yes.
All right.
Specifically limited the issues to arbitration and specifically said the arbitrator could not determine whether the issue was arbitrable or not. We contended throughout that it was not arbitrable and, of course, could not appeal under Wisconsin state law our appeal time. Though we sought an interlocutory appeal that was denied, we could not appeal the decision to go to arbitration, sending us to arbitration, until it was complete. Now, we are therefore under 788, under Chapter 788, appealing the judgment. I think we are not doing any violence whatever to 788. I want to return to the concern I have, if I may, about a remand. The I think the problem that was faced by the circuit court, the tribal court, and the parties when after the last remand was trying to ascertain how to approach the issue. There were no protocols in effect. Judge Gallagher used a draft that was radically different than the ones that were adopted, and I think in so doing illustrated some of the problems involved in going outside of 806.245, looking to whether the tribe had a jury system, looking to whether or not the tribe had separation of powers, looking to whether or not this was a political question. But apart from that, the question was, well, we already have judgments. The tribe had moved.
Apart from that, the question is what? I didn't hear that.
I'm sorry. Apart from that, we already have judgments here. In effect, both courts have judgments. So what do we do about that? The tribe moved to reopen, thinking that created a mechanism, at least in the circuit court, to frame it within the rules. Again, Mr. Teague elected not to file anything whatever with the tribal court, so that court judgment, there was no mechanism whatever there to open the door. But at the end, the judges concluded, well, we are where we are. And my concern...
So was it a perfunctory hearing?
No, I think that would be not fair at all. No, it was the transcript. I thought it participated. Both counsel for Mr. T participated. It was on the record, and I thought it was thoughtful, and it was perplexed, and in many ways I think enlightening for all. But at the end too, there was not a ground on which to. It was simply a discretionary. What are the rules? Well, I don't know exactly what the rules are.
Mr. Jacobson, if I might interrupt for a minute, let me ask you this. You're asking that we apply 806.245. One of the troubling aspects of your request, I think, is that the judgment rendered by the tribal court was a default judgment. How do you handle the argument that is a troubling aspect and maybe overrides the application of 806.245?
It relates to the issue of whether it was on the merits.
Justice Crooks, in Wisconsin the law is, I think this is again American law generally, that a default judgment and rendered by a court that has jurisdiction is a judgment on the merits of res judicata as to matters that are clearly pleaded in the complaint. All of the matters that we seek full faith and credit on were clearly pleaded in the complaint. There was jurisdiction, and I may add here that there was no rush to judgment. There was nothing tricky or untoward about the tribal court's approach, or I think the litigant's approach, reflected again by the fact if the default nature of this somehow colors 806.245, then I think what happens is that any future litigant outside of the Tenth Circuit can conclude, well, if we're in a tribal court thing, we're truly going to just default.
Let me probe what happened with the default judgment. Was there any hearing held by the tribal court?
Yes, Your Honor, there was. The entire transcript of the hearing is in the appellant's appendix in this matter. There was, prior to the hearing filed, the transcripts of all of the actually quite extensive depositions that were taken. Mr. Teague and his witnesses of the tribal chair. There was an extensive brief filed, all served on Mr. Teague's counsel. And in fact, I was noticing in the reviewing the record preparing for this that on the tribe's own motion, the default hearing was extended. It was postponed on one occasion. There was simply no
shell game where it suddenly happened. This was a case illustrated, I think, by the fact that when you remanded, and during the conference, as reflected in the transcript of the conference, Judge Gallagher asked Mr. Teeth counsel, what would happen if I simply said, I'm going to reopen this case and you should go to tribal court. The answer, again, and there were many words, but effectively the answer was, we don't want to go to tribal court. There was never, in other words, not only before the default, but after the remand, there never has been a willingness to go. It was a conscious, I'm sure, reasoned decision. But if the default colors 806.245, it seems to me that's what we sanction. We say we're going to say those faith and credit is different if a litigant chooses simply not to present its arguments.
Is there any question about notice? Is the record clear that notice was given to Mr. Teeth's counsel?
It was, notice was given, the service was proper, service was acknowledged. In fact, before the default hearing, the attorney in my office, there's an affidavit from him in the record, Mr. Halloran, called Mr. Teeth's then counsel and said, we're going to have a default hearing. And the response was, my client is not going to participate. I think it would hurt his case in Wisconsin court.
Mr. Jacobson, it seems to me that there's a basic disagreement between the parties as to what our decision in Teague means.
I think that's so.
And I think that that may be the crux if we're going to decide the case. So tell me what you think Teague stands for and what you want it to stand for. Maybe they're one and the same.
I suspect they are.
Okay. Tell me what you think Teague stands for.
I think Teague stands for this court's, as Justice Vavlich said, this court's tremendous reluctance to either sanction this court's tremendous reluctance to have to choose between two sets of courts and two judgments. And this court's hope that the principles of comity might have permitted the courts to agree that one or both judgments would be reopened, that one or both courts could reallocate or reassign jurisdiction and proceed harmoniously to a judgment. I think Teague stands for the proposition that it was premature, and I think that word is used, premature to reach the question of full faith and credit under 806.245 because the notions of comity hadn't been properly applied in the first instance.
What do you think the other interpretation of Teague is?
Well, I understand, and I'm sure Mr. Teague's counsel...
I'm going to ask Ms. Hannon.
I'm sure. My understanding is that 806.245 in Mr. Teague's view has been effectively glossed by notions of comity, that it really isn't full faith and credit in the normal sense, that if you were coming from Iowa, but rather it is a discretionary inquiry where discretionary factors not listed by the legislature can and should be appropriately applied.
Are they limited to those discretionary factors listed by the legislature?
Well, that's very unclear. I'm sorry. Maybe
106.045 has some factors listed. It uses the term full faith and credit. If it doesn't really mean full faith and credit as we interpret it for sister states, sister sovereign states, it doesn't mean that when we're dealing with a tribal court, if it doesn't mean that. Are there elements other than the ones listed that the court can consider under the doctrine that full faith and credit equals comity?
Speaking of my own position.
Right. Your own position is no.
I think the legislature clearly didn't contemplate that. And I think that
You think the legislature
clearly did not contemplate additional factors, additional discretionary factors, and the evils, it seems to me, that are worked by allowing that door to open are illustrated here. If we begin looking at one another's governments, systems, jury selection, separation of powers, the wedge enters. And it seems to me the burden is put on the two sets of courts, because it seems to me what's sauce for the goose is sauce for the gander. If tribal courts are obliged to give full faith and credit in order to get full faith and credit under 806.245, I assume that the full faith and credit that tribal courts are to give is the same. And if discretionary factors like the nature of... I see my time is up.
Finish your sentence.
I assume that if discretionary factors of the kind that were discussed by the circuit court are allowed in a state court's analysis, they must be allowed in a tribal court's analysis, and that, I think, is a tremendously divisive wedge.
And you think that's what Teague says?
I think that's what Teague does not say. I think that Teague should deny the existence of other discretionary factors. Yes.
Could I ask Mr. Jacobson when the tribal court was created?
Well before these proceedings, and my rebuttal, I'll have a specific answer to Justice Prosser. I can't tell you a date, but long, long before these proceedings, the tribal court was in. And the tribal constitution expressly, which was adopted well before that, expressly contemplates the existence of a tribal court. Now that resources are available, a court can actually function. But I beg indulgence, and I will have a specific date.
Thank you, Mr. Jacobson. Attorney Hannon, representing Jerry T.
May it please the court, counsel, guests. I'm Beth Ermatinger Hannon, and with my co-counsel, Andrew Erlinson, we represent the respondent, Mr. Jerry Teague. The legacy of this case will come from Teague 2, your decision 2 years ago, where for the first time you interpreted 806.245. You identified that the legislature had codified principles of comity within the statute. And you also concluded, paragraphs 28, 31, 35, that application of that statute is a discretionary act. Consequently, it's subject to the standard of review for an erroneous exercise of discretion. This decision, which I think we can call Teague 3, will not have nearly as broad effects as your decision 2 years ago. That's because the factual underpinnings of this case not only are unique, have not been brought to these appellate courts before, but because of what you did in Teague 2, should not recur. Thus, perhaps to allay some of your discomfort, Justice Babbage, you can write a very narrow holding based on these particular unlikely-to-recur facts. That will do no harm to the protocol that was established between the 10th Judicial Circuit and the four tribes in northern Wisconsin.
What is that very narrow holding? If you were writing it, what would you write?
The narrow holding is that the state court, on the motion to remand, and in its reaffirmance of its decision under 806.245, used its discretion, applied principles of comity, as this court had directed, and reached a decision a reasonable court could reach. And we know from multiple decisions from this court and the Court of Appeals that when a state court exercises its discretion, looks at the applicable facts, considers the applicable law, and makes a reasonable decision, not necessarily one that one of you or all of you might reach yourselves, you should affirm that.
But your narrow holding, it seems to me, has a predicate that is very broad. And that predicate is that the state courts are supreme over the Indian court. You said the narrow holding is the state court used its discretion. Well, what about the tribal court? Why can't the tribal court exercise its discretion? And, of course, I'll also bring on right to the same question to ask your opposing counsel. Why can't we send this back?
Admittedly, Your Honor, the authority of the Wisconsin Supreme Court is over the Circuit Court of Wisconsin, and you cannot direct the tribal courts what to do or not. Thus, you are called upon to look at what it is the state court did in this case. And in this case, as Mr. Jacobson acknowledged, it was not a perfunctory conference. This jurisdictional allocation conference that was held at your directive was respectful, was thorough. I believe it went almost 2 hours. If you look at pages 4 through 14 of the record of that conference, much of those pages are taken up with the perspective that Judge Smert from the Tribal Council shared with Judge Gallagher and the parties about his views of tribal court procedure, jurisdiction, and some concerns about matters that had already been resolved by the state court before the band even filed its overlapping proceeding in tribal court.
But I assume that if instead of Judge Gallagher writing the decision, that the tribal judge wrote the decision, he would have decided completely the opposite.
That may be, Your Honor.
Well, that's the problem that we're in.
And I understand the inclination to remand, because it is a difficult case.
Would you object if we remanded and told them to, and directed that you apply some 7 of the protocols?
I think there are several concerns with remanding this particular case for application of a protocol, which admittedly this case generated that protocol, and one of the parties in this case was very involved in developing that protocol. So for those reasons, and I think persons that have dealt with development of protocols might also have some concern in any case should a protocol be applied where a band itself is a party, as opposed to other matters that may come up a bit more routinely, such as family law matters, custody matters, that type of thing. But because it is spawned from this litigation and was developed while this litigation was still pending with the participation of one of the parties, I don't think it's appropriate in this particular case to remand for that protocol. And that is not to say that the protocol is not a very helpful step, that it may well be a model for other judicial districts and tribes within Wisconsin. Indeed, it's been acclaimed as a national model.
I'm correct that the tribal judge would have decided precisely the opposite of Judge Gallagher. Then isn't there a tiebreaker needed in order to give fairness to both parties, and the protocol gives us that tiebreaker?
The protocol does provide for a tiebreaker. I still think it is within this court's realm to review for an exercise of discretion Judge Gallagher's second look.
I think it is a tiebreaker.
I do, Your Honor, for this case. In writing your narrow holding, you can certainly applaud the use of protocols in subsequent cases, and those will be cases where a jurisdictional allocation conference will have been held, as Mr. Jacobson says, before any judgments come into being. but early in the litigation. That's what makes this case difficult, unusual, hardly likely to be repeated.
If we sent this back, it would seem to me we'd have to vacate both judgments.
And you don't have the power to do that.
We can't. We may not have the power to do the tribal one. We clearly have the power to do, I say clearly, maybe we have the power to do the circuit court and say, try it again. Now, if it were remanded, what would the issue on remand be? As I see it, if you have two standing judgments, the issue on remand is whether, how does 806.045 apply, right?
I think your decision in Team 2 raises a question
as to whether that applies. You interpret T2 as that really decided the key issues that's bothering Justice Babbage. But you, if I understand your position, T2 says 806.045 is not, says it's not full faith and credit as we understand that term. That 806.045 says it's comity, C-O-M-I-T-Y, right?
Yes.
And that, if I understand your position, when it says comity, it includes not only the elements that are set forth in the statute, but it includes a multitude of other factors.
That's correct, Your Honor.
That's your position.
Yes.
And it might very well include some of the factors that are set forth in 7, because many of them might be looked at.
It may. And as this court is aware, when Judge Gallagher invited Judge Smart to the jurisdictional allocation conference in March of 2001, we did not have a final protocol. There was a draft protocol, which the judges were able to read. And while counsel for the band may dispute the quality of the draft protocol, Judge Gallagher and Judge Smart also had the benefit of several commentaries from law professors whose opinions have been solicited by the Wisconsin Tribal Judges Association that were not in harmony necessarily with the draft protocol. This all goes to say that the state court, when it exercised its discretion at the jurisdictional allocation conference, considered multiple principles of comity, the submissions of the parties. And to put it in perspective, in February of 1997, when the band first came to the state court to say, now, 13, 14 months later, we filed a tribal court judgment and we think you should stop the state court action and let the tribal judgment proceed. Effectively, Judge Gallagher did a jurisdictional allocation at that point. He considered the limited but simple question presented at that point in the pleadings of the tribal court, recognized fully that he could not stop the tribal court from proceeding with that, but allocated, in a sense, the jurisdiction for deciding the apparent authority question, which was in the state court proceeding, which had been ongoing at that time. It's true, as you recognize in T2, that his decision a year later focused on the first to file or prior action pending rule of Cyber v. Hahn, which you say cannot be a rule that unilaterally undoes tribal court jurisdiction. But that was not the only consideration that Judge Gallagher made when he did this original jurisdictional allocation in 97, when he reviewed the motion under 806.245 in 98. He considered orderly administration of justice. He considered the party's own agreement to forum selection. There's never been a dispute that the forum selection clause was in the 1993 contract and was in the 1995 contract. If your decision reverses the circuit court's reasonable determination, you'll be sending the message that tribes cannot include forum selection clauses in their contracts. I don't think that's the message the court wants to send.
What's your chief argument against us doing what the Court of Appeals did here? The Court of Appeals looked at this case and said 806-245 applies. We're going to give full faith and credit to the tribal court judgment. We're going to reverse the Court of Appeals decision. What's your chief argument against us taking that approach, assuming we're not going to remand?
The first argument is that when you said 2 years ago that the statute is notably silent in the face of inconsistent overlapping judgments, and that it appeared the legislature had never contemplated this situation, that answer is that 806-245 was not intended and does not apply when we've reached the point of two inconsistent judgments.
Aren't you reading T2 very broadly? Didn't we ever say clearly in T2 that 806-245 doesn't apply?
You did not use those words, and you weren't asked to at that point because of the remand for a jurisdictional allocation conference. You did not know what the outcome would be of that conference. It could well have been that one court decided to withhold its jurisdiction, and then there would only be one judgment. So it would have been dicta under the circumstances that faced you 2 years ago to go ahead and make that step. But I think you strongly hinted at it by saying that the statute is silent and the legislature did not contemplate this sort of facts. In other situations where you said the statute that the party seeks to apply is silent, such as in the Fuchsgruber case recently, State versus Pahota, and Kyle S.G., in those cases where the statute applied for is silent, you have looked to other areas of the law, the common law, or other statutes. And in this case, we circle back to principles of comity.
Now, Judge Gallagher did two things. One, he reviewed jurisdictional allocation, as I read his opinion. And two, he refused to reopen his judgment.
That's correct, Your Honor.
And his judgment does not give full faith and credit, whatever, however that term is used, to the tribal court.
That's correct. And in doing so, he made findings which are extensive, which refer to the facts in the record and refer to legal support not only identified by this court in Teague 2, but gleaned from other authorities submitted to both courts concerning comity principles. And when the court has made those type of detailed findings, it's your duty to sustain that exercise of discretion.
Ms. Hammond, if we keep the case and decide the case, one of my inclinations is to take into account very seriously.
Jurisdiction, of which there are nine of them. Do we have sufficient record that we could decide these cases without decide these facts without factors without remanding, so that when applying these factors, do we have sufficient in the record?
Well, the first factor is issues that touch on interpretation of a tribe's constitution, bylaws, ordinances. There are organic documents that are in the record. Whether the nature of the case involves traditional or cultural matters, I don't believe there's been any assertion that this wrongful termination, breach of an employment contract, involves such matters. Mm-hmm. Whether the action is one where a tribe is a party, that's acknowledged. Tribal membership status of the parties, not in question. Where the case arises.
That's not a question, is it?
No. Number six, if the parties have by their contract chosen a forum.
We have the original agreement.
We have the original and the subsequent contracts. Yes, Your Honor, those are
Did
in there,
they choose
including
a forum,
the clause.
A forum?
Yes, Your Honor. By virtue of the arbitration clause under Chapter 788, they did. And I should make one point.
And the law to be applied. So the forum was arbitration, not a court.
Well, what happened first, the forum was arbitration, and under Littman versus Littman, this state takes seriously a party's right to choose where to file his action, and the action Mr. Teague filed was to confirm the validity of his contract so that it could go to arbitration. I did want to point out, while we're on this Chapter 788 question, the amicus brief makes a footnote argument that arbitration should not even apply because there's an exception within 788 to contracts between, or clauses between employers and employees. But as you know, 788.01 incorporates Chapter 111, Employment Relations Statute, which defines under sub 6 employees as non-managerial persons. And we know that Jerry Teague was hired by the band to be the manager of the tribal casino. Over 60 employees under his supervision, and he did his job by dramatically increasing revenues at that operation. So certainly the arbitration clause is valid and doesn't fall to the objection raised by the amicus. A couple more.
Yeah, I'd like you to go through them because this is where we may end up.
The timing of the motion to dismiss, taking into account expenditure of time and resources, and compliance with any applicable scheduling orders. Now, if an interpretation of tribal organic law was so critical, the record doesn't show us why the band waited 13 or 14 months to file an action in tribal court. Because Mr. Teague filed his action originally in 1995, and it wasn't until late 1996 that the band filed the overlapping action. A couple of months after that, it then brought its motion to stay, at which point we viewed Judge Gallagher's initial assessment to be a sort of jurisdictional allocation at that point. He wasn't going to stay the state court proceedings. It would continue under the apparent authority pleadings, but the limited question whether full tribal council signatures were needed in tribal court, that could proceed within tribal court. Scheduling orders, I think there had been a scheduling order in the state court action, which at the end of this motion to stay hearing was further amended. The court in which the action can be decided most expeditiously. I'm not sure.
Sort of moot, isn't it?
Well.
Both courts have decided. What about number 9? Are there other factors that you want this court to consider?
This comes to you really as a generic forum selection case. Parties are entitled to enter into agreements to choose forum. And here, the parties bargained. Mr. Teague, the tribal council chair at the time, Mr. Moore, and the tribe's lawyer. You can see in both Mr. Teague's deposition testimony and the trial testimony of Mr. Moore and Mr. Teague, pages 65, page 206, that there was a recognition that the job he was taking was political. And for that reason, he was concerned that if there was ever a dispute over termination, he wanted to be in a different forum. That's not an offensive notion. In other employment contracts, there will be forum selection, maybe because the state's laws vary as far as non-compete or confidentiality provisions go. There may be a difference between jurisdictions on statutes of repose or damage caps. There are all sorts of inoffensive reasons that parties are perfectly entitled to consider and bargain for to make a forum selection choice, and that's what happened in this case. And there's no dispute that that choice was made.
That forum selection clause, however, is only as good as the contract is good, and we have a tribal court judgment that's saying this is not a valid contract. And we have to ultimately decide whether to give that judgment full faith and credit under the statute.
You're right, Your Honor, and we also have a state court judgment based on a jury verdict, which, as Judge Gallagher said when he decided the motion under 806245 in 1998, that he would give the parties free rein to put in any evidence they wanted on both actual authority and apparent authority. And so that issue was fully aired in front of the jury. We have the two competing jurisdictions, maybe perhaps because the two judges didn't talk earlier or their counsel didn't get them to talk earlier, but Judge Gallagher did try to allocate jurisdiction in 1997. He considered statutory factors and principles of comity and tribal exhaustion in 1998, and again in 2001 on remand from you. He, with the insights provided by Judge Smart, considered those principles and reached a reasonable decision. It's a decision that we believe, and I think Mr. Jacobson essentially agreed, just won't have to be made again by any judge.
Does Judge Gallagher's decision on remand stand for the proposition that the tribal court judgment in this case was without jurisdiction?
It does, and I think it's jurisdiction not in a generic personal or subject matter sense, but in a sense of what is jurisdiction that we look at when we make a comity determination. And this court's already acknowledged comity is part of 806245. As far back as, I think it's 1896, Northwestern Iron versus Lehigh, where there were two different actions, and the second filed action reached judgment first, the court talked about jurisdiction, saying not in the absolute sense of personal or subject matter, but where we have these comity considerations to make. Granted, those were two proceedings in different circuits of a single state, but it's this idea of jurisdiction for comity principles that I believe Judge Gallagher applied and is what is meant by this statute.
Thank you, Ms. Hannon. Your time is up. Mr. Erlinson.
Thank you, Chief Justices. May it please the court, my name is Andrew Erlinson. I'll be addressing five issues rather rapidly. Four of them involve alleged errors made by the trial court. Each is a discretionary ruling, and there is contended by the petitioner that there were errors that occurred. The first of those issues is the trial court's determination that the band was estopped from asserting that the contracts at issue in this case were void for lack of BIA approval. Now, the decision to apply the doctrine of estoppel is a discretionary one, and therefore it is reviewed under an erroneous exercise of discretion standard. As the record reflects, the court applied the proper standard of law, considered the applicable facts, and reached a determination a reasonable judge could reach. Teague explained the purpose of his contract at trial. Then-chairman tribal chairman Donald Moore had been voted out of office. He was very concerned that the successor to the tribal chairship would arbitrarily terminate Teague in a political move because she was Moore's rival. Mr. Moore wanted an enforceable contract that prevented Teague's arbitrary termination. This agreement was supposed to have teeth. Jerry Teague specifically requested to not have to enforce his contract, the binding contract that the band clearly wanted to enter into. He specifically requested not to have to try to enforce that agreement in tribal court. The chair then consulted with the tribal attorney in Teague's presence as he testified at trial, and the tribal attorney suggested an arbitration clause under Wisconsin statutes. The whole purpose of this contract was to make sure it was binding. The other banned witnesses at trial testified that they did not believe that the gaming operation operated under the corporate charter where the BIA provision appears. It does not appear in the Constitution, and therefore no one at the time that the contract was entered into believed the BIA provision to be applicable. Now, regardless of what the circuit court did with respect to determinations of whether the Constitution or the corporate charter applied subsequent to the original contract, shouldn't matter. Because even if there that determination that the corporate charter applied operated as some kind of relation back device to create a legal right inuring to the tribe's benefit, the doctrine of estoppel can bar a party from asserting a legal right where the equities dictate that it's just not fair. And we submit, in this case, it wouldn't be fair to reach back, void an agreement based on a provision no one believed applied. The doctrine of estoppel applies when there is action or inaction that induces reliance by another. Here, there was inaction. No one at the tribal court believed that the corporate charter applied. No one raised the issue. There's no question that everybody wanted the contract to be binding. Teague obviously relied on that action or inaction. He signed the contract and he worked under it. And everything was fine until the BIA issue arose subsequently after tribal court proceedings began. Now, the ban relies on the testimony of Elizabeth Drake, who was the successor to Donald Moore in the tribal chairship. She testified on cross-examination that she never got BIA approval because she didn't know it. She had to. And she also had submitted an affidavit that said that she believed that the corporate charter did apply. Now, there are two problems with relying on that testimony. One is that Elizabeth Drake entered into the second of the two contracts. The relevant facts as to estoppel are those applicable to the first contract, because there were no intervening changes between the first contract in 1993 and the second contract in 1995. Whatever reliance Teague placed on the action or inaction in 1993 were the same operating principles that were at work in 1995. Moreover, on redirect, Ms. Drake clarified her awareness of the BIA issue. There was a $1.7 million casino buyout that was engaged by the tribe under Ms. Drake's leadership. When asked about, well, did you get BIA approval for that contract? She said, well, no, I contacted the tribal attorney and we didn't because there were tribal funds involved. Well, clearly Mr. Teague was being paid with tribal funds. So Ms. Drake's testimony, as it's relied on by the band, is not nearly as probative on the point of the application of the BIA approval clause as the band would contend. The second issue that the band alleges error by the trial court has to deal with jury members. The decision to exclude jurors is a discretionary determination. Where there is a financial interest that a prospective juror has in the outcome of a case, even a tiny one, bias is presumed and the juror should be excluded. The band contends that there was no evidence submitted by Teague. Not true. Teague, in his moving papers, cited the deposition transcript of one of the band council members, Joe Dan Rose, and also cited the corporate charter, which makes all members of the Bad River Corp, all Bad River Band members, also members of the tribal corporation. And as members of the tribal corporation, they are eligible for dividend payments. Now, despite the fact that there had not historically been dividend payments, certainly it doesn't bar the band from making them in the future. And the potential for an adverse result in this case certainly wasn't going to hasten that day. So Judge Gallagher identified which of the prospective jurors were enrolled members of the Bad River Band and excluded them as a result of their financial interest. There was evidence before the court in the form of the citations to the corporate charter, the citation of Mr. Rose, and also the testimony of the prospective jurors that they were indeed Bad River Band members. Based on that financial interest in the outcome of this case, Judge Gallagher exercised his discretion and excluded those individuals from serving on the jury. The next issue that the band contends was an error was the exclusion of three proposed exhibits. Now, these exhibits all came in about a 24-hour period. They were produced in about a 24-hour period in July of 1995, and they were two memos drafted by Jerry Teague, the respondent, and one memo drafted by Elizabeth Drake, then tribal chair. Those documents were produced at a time when Jerry Teague's controversial 1995 contract had been made public to many around the Bad River Reservation. There had been a tremendously contentious tribal council meeting on July 17th to determine what was going on with this contract and whether or not Jerry Teague should be fired. And the tape of that meeting was played at the arbitration, and it was an extremely contentious, volatile meeting. Drake went home after that meeting and talked to Teague. And essentially, as documents, exhibits, proposed exhibits 103 and 104 make clear, they decided they had to do something. And what they decided to do was Teague was going to be terminated, not for cause, under his original contract. He was going to accept severance together with a letter of recommendation, and everybody was going to move on with their lives. The night of the July 17th meeting, Teague was aware of it. He laid out in Exhibit 102 his side of the story. And his side of the story, in conjunction with the termination under the 1993 contract, was going to get him extricated from this volatile situation. Drake would have the political and practical solutions she desired, and everybody would move on with their lives. If this case had settled, as it was indicated in Exhibits 103 and 104, everyone in this room would have been saved a whole lot of trouble. That's the whole purpose of excluding settlement discussions under 90408. Settlements are to be encouraged. Parties are encouraged to find solutions so that they don't have to litigate for years and years and years, and they should be able to have discussions in those settlement talks without fear that in the event that the agreement doesn't come to fruition, that these statements are going to be used against them later. Now, the trial court looked at these documents, and trial courts have broad discretion on issues of evidentiary rulings. He applied the relevant law. He considered the relevant facts, and he reached a decision a reasonable judge could reach. As a result, that discretionary ruling should be sustained. The final alleged error made by the trial court was with respect to jury instructions proposed by the band. The band proposed two instructions, one of which dealt with the BIA issue, which the court had resolved with its estoppel ruling, and the second was an instruction which, in essence, said there's no such thing as apparent authority in governments, and therefore you can't rely on apparent authority as a means to contract, or Teague couldn't. As support for this proposed instruction, the band cited a handful of cases which involved the first of which was a Supreme Court case that involved the federal crop insurance program, and the remainder of the cases arose from the Court of Claims, and I see my time is up.
You may finish your sentence.
They dealt with the unique situation that you have with the very technical and very complete regulatory contracting mechanism for the U.S. government. They were not applicable to Indian tribes, and therefore the trial court properly rejected them as a proposed
instruction. Justice Savage has a question, counsel.
Counsel, in rejecting the argument of apparent authority, or in some other under some other circumstances, do we have a ruling in this record that Teague was justified in relying on the signature of the tribal chief?
Yes, the special verdict question Justice Babich asked: did the parties enter into a valid contract in 1993, was the contract validly modified in 1995? It was a two-part question, and if the jury answered the first question yes, they moved on to the second question. The jury was instructed completely on the law of authority.
On lawful authority and apparent authority?
Yes, because there was some question, if I may. There was some question as to whether or not the original resolution that was passed by the Tribal Council in 1993 contained some implicit or explicit authorization for the tribal chair to amend the contract as that party saw fit. And so instructions as to actual authority and apparent authority were given. There were no discrete findings with respect to whether or not the jury relied on one theory or the other.
But Judge Gallagher has never made implicitly or explicitly a finding on apparent authority. Or has he made a conclusion of law?
With respect to the applicability of apparent authority to Indian tribes?
Under whether or not Teague's actions, that he was justified in believing he had a contract. I mean, the argument here, as I understand it, is the tribe says, hey, you didn't have a contract because only the tribal chief signed it and not, or the tribal chairman signed it and not the council. And Teague says, well, I looked at this contract and I assume that the tribal chairman had the authority to bind the council. Isn't that the argument?
Wait. Yes. Essentially, that's the argument. Judge Gallagher never made a finding one way or the other, never made a ruling, because I would imagine nobody moved for summary judgment because there were a whole lot of disputes of fact, and it was put to the jury.
Chief, if I may. Counsel, were there motions after judgment, and did he enter judgment on the verdict?
No, because there was nothing to enter in terms of a judgment. After the verdict, Teague moved for an order compelling arbitration under the contract, and because there was no finding that anybody had breached the contract, as far in terms of money payments, the next procedural step was proceed to arbitration.
And then, what was the appeal taken from if there wasn't a final order or judgment of the court?
The arbitration took place during the summer of 1995, after the decision was issued from the arbitrator. Teague moved to have the judgment entered on that amount. The court had effectively continued its jurisdiction over the case pending the arbitration. The arbitrator's ruling was recognized, approved, and judgment was entered thereon, and the original appeal ensued.
Another question with respect to on the same matter. Was an argument ever made in the court, in the state court, that the tribal council had implicitly approved these contracts by failure to rescind them or anything of that sort?
I don't believe
there were two contracts here, and I would assume members of the tribal council knew that there was a contract between that had been signed by the tribal chairman and Mr. Teague.
Correct. The 1993 contract was amended by its terms by the 1995 contract. The 1995 contract expressly said it was amending.
Was Drake a member of the tribal council in 93?
No, she was not. She was elected but had not taken office as tribal chair. So she was not a member of the council. Correct.
Are these appropriate matters for us to get into if we're going to decide the merits?
Well, I would submit, Justice Babich, that the issue of whether there was sufficient evidence to support a jury's verdict has not been appealed and has not been briefed. I believe that there was sufficient evidence that a reasonable jury could conclude, certainly when the evidence is construed in the light most favorable to Mr. Teague, which I believe would be the standard.
Thank you, counsel.
Thank you, Your Honors.
Mr. Jacobson.
Mr. Jacobson, I have a question before you begin. Do you read Judge Gallagher's, or understand Judge Gallagher's remand decision to be that the tribal judgment in this case was rendered without jurisdiction for purposes of the full faith and credit statute?
Justice Sykes, that it happens was the first thing I was going to address. Page 22 of the transcript of the hearing of that conference,
I will quote Judge Gallagher. We both have jurisdiction. We have concurrent jurisdiction. The question is who should try the case. I have tried it. Also, earlier on page 21, Judge Gallagher, this is the, you know, the conference after remand, Judge Gallagher said, I never said that the tribal court did not have jurisdiction. I think in that way his memory was a little not quite accurate because, of course, that was, he said Cyber versus Hahn deprived the tribal court of jurisdiction. But clearly, having been reversed on Cyber versus Hahn, Judge Gallagher explicitly said both courts have jurisdiction.
But didn't he then, at the end of his decision, address the full faith and credit issue and essentially reapply Snyder versus Hahn, which we said didn't apply?
It looks like it snuck back in. Yes, I think that's right.
H-U-N.
On page 30, the final page of the transcript, Chief Justice, again, this is Judge Gallagher starting on line 9, concerning the whole faith and credit problem. I think it's significant, although the appellate court didn't talk about it, I still think it's significant that the statute only applies to Wisconsin Tribal Court. That's not actually where I wanted to be. I apologize. At the end of his deliberations, effectively he said that he thought it was extremely significant that the state court case was the first case to be filed, and that was a significant factor in his deciding not to reopen and not to give full faith and credit. Yes. Several other points in response, if I may, to Justice Sykes. Does that answer your question?
Yes. Thank you.
I have a question. The tribe relies on Section 5F of the Charter.
Yes.
Provides that any contract involving payment of tribal corporate monies in excess of $1,000 in any one year must be approved. Are you representing to the court that every expenditure in excess of $1,000 involving a contract is approved?
No, Your Honor. No, Justice Prosser. By the way, the answer to your earlier question is 1986. This, if I may, leads into the tribal charter, tribal constitution issue that is critical, I think, in this case. Though counsel for Mr. Teague has said no one really thought the tribal charter applied for this reason, for your reason and others. The law of this case, based on the complaint filed by Mr. Teague's counsel, the affidavits of his witnesses, his entire contention throughout this case is that the tribal charter applies. The complaint filed in 1995 alleges, in paragraph, I believe, 4, that this business, the casino, and this contract are governed by the corporate charter. In 1996, when Judge Gallagher denied the motion to dismiss and said, no, the Constitution and its protections don't apply. This has to run under the corporate charter. I agree with Mr. Teague, this runs under the corporate charter. Mr. Teague had submitted an affidavit from Ms. Drake in resisting the motion to dismiss. The affidavit said, at all times, we thought this was running under the corporate charter, and his contracts were signed under the corporate charter. That became the law of the case when Judge Gallagher ruled in 1996.
Well, let me ask. The tribe must enter into all kinds of contracts, purchase orders, employment contracts, all kinds of contracts. Are you saying whenever they fail to send it to the BIA, the contract is valid or invalid at their option?
No, Justice Prosser, not at all. No. Were the business in all senses at all times running under the corporate charter, clearly that would be the case, and it's a good reason why it doesn't run under the corporate charter. But in this case, the law of this case, the tribe contended throughout that the Constitution applied, that the corporate charter didn't apply. Mr. Teague said, no, it's the corporate charter.
It's the corporate charter. I think Mr. Teague did that because he saw a sue and be sued clause in the corporate charter. I don't know. It's not clear in the record. That's speculation entirely. But Mr. Teague contended and Judge Gallagher ruled in this case, a ruling that was never appealed, that the corporate charter was the operative document for these contracts, for these purported contracts.
Allow me to put aside the legalities for a moment and talk about what the tribal council knew. When this was entered into, when this contract was entered into, did the tribal council know or at some point thereafter find out that and essentially remain silent during the terms of Mr. Teague's contract?
Two documents. 1995 document, tribal council never knew. Several members had been shown drafts, never brought to the tribal council, and when, as Mr. Erlandson alluded to, when the terms of the 1995 document hit the press, material hit the fan, it was, and shortly thereafter, Mr. Teague departed Bad River's employment, whether voluntarily or involuntarily. The 1993 agreement, he operated under for 2 years. It was, however, amended without the council's knowledge after the council had approved it. It was a relatively minor amendment, but nonetheless, the document itself was never approved by the tribal council. And in any case, again, Justice Babbage, if I may, it is tremendously important, I think, that the court understand what happened at trial with the corporate charter. It is central. It is another reason this case should end if full faith and credit doesn't apply, because the corporate charter, which Judge Gallagher found to be the operative document, was not the argument that the BIA had to approve this contract was never permitted to be made to the jury. The jury instruction that the tribe requested under the corporate charter was denied. Because, Judge Gallagher said, everyone thought...
He said, I didn't do that.
Because, Judge Gallagher said, boy, everyone thought you were operating under the Constitution, so we're not going to allow you to make that argument, the BIA argument.
Can I ask one other question? I couldn't hear you. Did you say that this went back to the... that the council did approve this? What was your...
Oh, I'm sorry. The two... In 93...
Yes.
It was the first contract... The document was approved, then amended, but not brought back. In 95, nothing was approved.
But I think the question Justice Babbage asked, just so I understand, the council did have this contract in front of them. How would it have been otherwise if they hadn't? They did approve it.
Which are we talking about?
93.
They had a version of 93.
Okay.
And they didn't act one way or the other, but they knew about it.
Oh, yes.
They had to have known about it. Everybody knew that Mr. Teague was managing this casino.
That's true. That's exactly right. Whereas 95 was a completely different matter.
On the protocol, suppose the tribe or any tribe or any party becomes disenchanted with the protocol. Can you pull out?
What happens? Well, or another way of putting the question, Justice Prosser, is that outside of the Tenth Circuit, there are seven tribes and there are the other circuits, which I submit may be a consideration for this court in terms of the importance of discretionary findings over and past 806.245. This case in the Tenth Circuit, as long as those protocols are in place, couldn't arise again, I think. In the Ninth Circuit, or in this circuit, if the protocols, for whatever reason, are abandoned, we will again have 806, we have 806.245. And I think the potential for the question arising again is there.
But what incentive would the tribe have to... stay under the protocol if you win the case?
Oh, there is immense incentive. Your Honor, th-
this case, well, the two sets of courts are working and have every interest in working together fairly closely. It's not as though there are far more judicial resources, tribal and state, in this than are required. I think no court is scrambling around to increase its caseload. There are cases all the time where if one party or the other decides to forum shop, if Mr. Teague did or if we did, I suppose we both did, we chose a forum, it becomes imperative for the courts to have a way outside of legal counsel to make a choice, a reasoned choice, given the circumstances, their resources, the issues presented, and the law involved. Which court should try it? It's no court's interest, neither court's interest, to go trying a case when someone else is trying it. The cooperation is essential, and that's what the protocols accomplish. Obviously, my time expired a little bit.
You indicated 7 tribes in this state, in addition to the party here. Outside of the record, I'm sure, but have other tribes declined to enter into protocols?
I'm not aware.
Other circuit courts declined to enter into protocols?
Justice Bradley, I'm not sure. But for the record, there are 11 tribes. There are 4 within the 10th, and so there are 7 outside the 10th. And I do not know whether it may be there are protocols outside. I am embarrassed by my ignorance, but again, I live in St. Paul. I
guess that explains it.
It explains a lot. I know.
Thank you.
Thank you. My time long expired.
Thank you, Mr. Jacobson. Thank you, Ms. Hannon and Mr. Aronson.